Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour, and today is Tuesday, December 21st, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. Feel free to go to that website. Click on the link that says Start Here in the upper left-hand corner. That will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. The book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? That chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 17 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional state into part of the infallible guidance system that each one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Print, download it, print it off, copy it, use it as often as you'd like. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness and get access to a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. We hope you do that soon and often because it leads to improvements in most people's lives when they do that, and it frequently leads people to have comments or questions or requests for support in applying the tools, and that's why we're here 5 days a week in our current format, 2 hours a day. Our call-in number, if you have any of those comments, questions, or requests for support, the call-in number is 563-999-3581. Call that number and press 1, and it'll put a little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I will announce you by your area code. We're also doing the Course in Miracles workbook lessons this year. Today is the 355th day of the year. Today's lesson reads, there is no end to all the peace and joy and all the miracles that I will give when I accept the Creator's word. Why not start today? Why should I wait, Creator, for the joy you promised me? For you keep your word that you gave your offspring, and I am sure my treasure waits for me, and I need but reach out my hand to find it. Even now my fingers touch it. It's very close. I need not wait an instant more to be at peace forever. It is you I choose and my identity along with you. Your offspring will be themselves and know them as you know yourself and your Creator and all of that which is love. Pam Grout's Course in Miracle Experiment book has a... I'm pulling it up here. Lesson 355 is titled The Ongoing Antics of My Mind. She quotes Natalie Sudman, who said, we all have a lot of enculturation that has muddied up who we are. Pam Grout writes, the asshat churns up thoughts. By some estimates, the average human brain regurgitates 60,000 to 90,000 thoughts per day. The war begins when I pluck a particular thought out of the normal litany and declare it to be a, quote, problem, close quotes. When I make myself wrong, say for being afraid to speak in public, that's when it owns me. Fear is a standard song in the jukebox of the human mind. It is the most normal thing in the world. I know fear's Apple ID, its first pet, the name of its kindergarten teacher. The trick is to put a period at the end of those thoughts. I am afraid, period. I think I can't speak, period. It's only when I start adding humiliating extra clauses, like, I'm afraid and that means there's something wrong with me. I'm panicking and that means I'm inferior. I'm terrified and that means I should just run away. It's only when that happens that it grows into an insurmountable thorn bush. What if I simply recognize that there's nothing bad or unnatural going on here? Under the thorn bush, waiting patiently for our awareness, is the truth from Lesson 355. That truth reads as follows. There is no end to all the peace and joy and miracles that I can give. And as I give them, I receive them. So that's our Course in Miracles workbook lesson and the Course in Miracles experiment commentary for today. Again, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, I'll announce you by your area code and we can have a conversation. How can we support you today? What's on your mind? I had an article I came across I thought I would share today if no one had a comment or a question. The article is about choosing to be a non-drinker. It was in the Huffington Post, and it's a topic that, especially around the holidays, might be challenging for people because so many people in our families and our culture just take it for granted that if you're 21 or older, and unless you're, you know, some serious alcoholic, you drink, and you drink what they call socially. Title of this article reads, I'm not an alcoholic, but I am a non-drinker. Here is why I quit. I slowly but radically changed my mind about alcohol's place in my life. Hi, I'm Kelly, and I'm not an alcoholic. I am a non-drinker. I've always prided myself on my ability to change my mind. I used to believe that I would never want to live anywhere but New York, that I would never marry, that I would never have children, and most frightening of all, I would never get a tattoo. Now I live in Seattle, I'm planning a wedding while daydreaming about baby names, and I have half a dozen tattoos. But the most momentous, life-altering thing that I've changed my mind about has been the most difficult and complicated adjustment yet. I had never envisioned my life without alcohol. And yet, here I am, at the age of 31, writing this with a glass of chai by my side instead of wine. Over the past year, I slowly but radically changed my mind about alcohol's place in my life, ultimately deciding to become a non-drinker. This was an unexpected development to both myself and the people around me, not because I had a drinking problem, but because I didn't. My belief that only alcoholics need to quit drinking was the barrier that kept me from ever analyzing my relationship with alcohol. Instead, I drank socially for more than a decade, bolstered by everyone around me who was doing exactly the same thing. I never questioned the strong drinks that were more vodka than cranberry that my older boyfriend would ply me with in college. I never questioned the fact that all of the worst fights I had with loved ones were preceded by drinking. I speculated that my health was being affected by some undiagnosed condition, PCOS, chronic fatigue syndrome, depression, and not the very normal drinking habits that I saw reflected in my friends and family and in the media that I consumed. Drink responsibly, we were told. Like many others, I took that as a reassurance that moderate drinking would not hurt me. Also, like many others, my alcohol intake increased during the pandemic. A glass or two of red wine, previously a bright spot at the end of the occasional hard day, suddenly became the only bright spot in a life that had become extremely small, stressful, and dull. Then three things happened at once. We moved apartments. I decided to do dry January. And I joined a friend in reading and discussing Holly Whitaker's book, Quit Like a Woman. Any one of those things would have been fantastic for shaking up my routine, but together they managed to wrench me free of alcohol's grip in a way I had never experienced before. Whitaker's book, in particular, not only helped me to complete my dry month, but made me actively not want to drink. This quote was one of many in her book that made me feel like I was seeing the world in a new light. Here's the quote. "I believe that alcohol will experience its own cigarette moment, a reversal in public opinion, and a rejection of it by mainstream culture. It will be seen as something that we used to do. Once we remove our willful ignorance of its harmful effects on us personally and collectively, I imagine our grandchildren will one day be shocked by the idea that there was once a point in time when we drank ethanol at almost every occasion. The same way I'm always shocked to see pictures of my aunts and uncles smoking indoors at family parties in the 70s. Since reading Whitaker's book, I've become keenly aware not only of alcohol's downsides, but also of the societal rejection that she predicted. Whether it's thanks to the work of quit lit writers like Whitaker and Annie Grace, the rising trend of celebrities like Drew Barrymore, Chrissy Teigen, and Real Housewife Luann de Lesseps, publicly renouncing alcohol, or the increasingly hard-to-ignore proof of alcohol's role in breast cancer, hormonal disruptions, and mental health issues, more and more women are becoming sober curious. A cultural shift is happening, one that allows for quitting booze to be seen as not just acceptable, but empowering, and an empowering act of feminism. After all, when we drink, we're not only potentially harming ourselves, but we are also supporting a male-dominated industry that targets women and benefits from our reliance on a highly addictive substance. Still, I didn't give up alcohol overnight. I drank in moderation for a few months, ordering Diet Coke at bars just as easily as I enjoyed some wine at my bridal shower. My drinking was controlled. Some would call it healthy. And yet, when I woke up the day after sharing a bottle of champagne with friends at a summer picnic, I was miserable. My anxiety clawed at my stomach, at my throat. My depression sat slick and heavy in my stomach. Ultimately, I would get back into bed, unable to play with my dog or work on my novel. I took a photo of my tear-streaked face in the dark bedroom, laughing a little at myself as I did so, and vowed to quit drinking for good. It's been 108 days now, and the steady hum of anxiety and fatigue that has been in the background for years has faded away. My sleep is actually restful now, giving me energy and motivation to pursue the things I'm interested in. Oh my God, and the time. I have unlocked so much time. If you're reading this and thinking, good for you, but that's not for me, that's fine. If you feel that alcohol isn't having a negative effect on your life, then I'm happy for you. Being a non-drinker can be an incredibly difficult choice in a culture that worships alcohol, and it's one that someone has to make for themselves with all the curiosity and excitement and courage that they can muster. Sometimes I still doubt my choice. Am I really not going to drink champagne at my wedding this summer? I had that thought. That seems drastic for someone who could go back to drinking moderately at any time and most likely be completely okay. But that's the thing. I don't want to go through life as just okay and the okay version of myself. I no longer want to dull any of my senses or my experiences. When I walk down the aisle in July, I won't down a glass of champagne first to quiet my nerves. Instead, I'll give myself the gift of feeling it all, the nerves, the joy, the excitement, the amazement, and I'll remember it later, too, every moment of it, exactly the way it was. That is the article that I thought was worth sharing today. It's from Kelly Duger, D-O-U-G-H-E-R. She's a guest writer for Huffington Post, and it appeared in HuffPost December 16th, 2021. I am a non-drinker. Here's why I quit, by Kelly Duger. So, perhaps that sparked some thoughts from someone. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. We're here on the winter solstice. It is December 21st, meaning after today, the days start getting longer. This will be the shortest daylight day of the year for where we live on this little globe. And if you're into this kind of thing, you might enjoy a song by Peter Mayer about the longest night of the year. And Peter Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, a wonderful singer-songwriter and lyricist from Minnesota, not to be confused with somebody who plays for the, the Margarita Deal Band, whatever that, my brain isn't letting me come up with that right now, but it will come to me. So, we've got about 40 minutes left to entertain your comments, your questions, your answers. Give us a call, 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. I was also entertained by an article about the renowned physicist David Bohm. But we may or may not get to that in a few minutes. I've turned on the microphone for Susan.
Hey, Dr. Tim, it's been a while. I liked hearing that.
Hello.
Having a newly sober grandson, and I just had a talk with him about the fact that among all the substances he was using, mainly pot, psychedelics, sometimes he would drink. And now he's living with his mother. He's going to meetings. He's seen friends. He's applied for a job, and he's gotten one job already in his field as a theater, an actor, singer, and teacher of theater to kids. He's really just coming back to himself, to a self that I hadn't seen since high school when he started smoking pot. But he was just saying how he thought he could probably have a glass of wine or a beer with his friends now and again, because the liquor was never one of the things he thought was a problem for him. And I didn't refute that. I said, I know your brother, you know, we did an intervention on him, and he didn't go into rehab, and he kind of thumbed his nose, but now he's, you know, a year and a half later, he's much better, but he still drinks some. He smokes cigarettes. He keeps it under control. He doesn't smoke any pot anymore. This is the older brother. And my middle grandson, the one we were just concerned about and who lived with us, was just mulling all this over. So that's such a wonderful article. With him, I just said the only thing I would worry about is if you take a drink, you may not be tempted to take any more than one drink, but will that make you more susceptible to accepting a puff of somebody's weed vape? Will it soften the edges of your resolve around the other things that have been problems? And he thought that was a good thought and that he would think about that. But addiction really is strange. He said he goes to AA meetings, but he doesn't call himself an alcoholic there. He just says, I am an addict. And he said, they're all fine with that. And actually, although it's an AA meeting for alcoholism, many of them use a lot of different kinds of things and consider themselves sort of pan-alcoholics or pan-addicts, I should say. So there's that. So that was a timely thing to read. Do you want to say anything about that before I ask a different question?
Well, I just want to point out what she's talking about here at the end of it. And I don't know, readers, listeners, watchers might have some experience with this or not. But those of us who are of a certain age remember when smoking was as common as drinking water.
Oh, yeah.
And recently, the Beatles released on one of the streaming platforms the documentary titled Get Back, and this is from 1969, and the ubiquitous presence of alcohol, I'm sorry, I meant to say of cigarettes and cigars in every scene. Somebody was either, you know, had a stubble of a cigarette in their fingers or was lighting one, or it's just amazing.
It's true.
And indoors, yeah, and around small kids. And so, you know, if you look at that and you say, wait a minute, how could that possibly be? That was only 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Well, 40 or 50 years ago. It can happen that a culture, mm-hmm, wakes up and recognizes, hey, asbestos isn't that good. Maybe we shouldn't make our clothes out of it and our buildings out of it. And so anyway, and I just want to point that out, that what she brings up in the article about how she believes our culture is going to have a wake-up call. It's going to have a moment where it recognizes that just because historically this stuff has been produced by humans for centuries and centuries and centuries, this thing, this ethanol thing, whether it's through mead or some other process of fermentation with vodka or beer or whatever, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good thing and that it's going to be seen as healthy and culturally acceptable forever.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. You had another point you were going to make or a question you were going to ask?
Well, there are a couple of things that I've been thinking about. One is a podcast I heard the other day about studies now that have come out for quite some time probably about how medicines gotten over, you know, prescription medicines to treat anxiety, depression, and so on, are found in the long run not to be, in most cases, not to be as effective as the taking of micronutrients and having a clean diet and a clean lifestyle and so forth and so on. This woman was very gentle about all this. She said, yes, oftentimes when somebody's in bad trouble, those medications save lives. They turn people around. They're a hugely good intervention to have. And then on the other hand, over the long run, far fewer people need all those meds. Some do all the rest of their lives. They're on medications, but most of them, she would say maybe 80%, can be weaned off of them while learning to eat right and take micronutrients. Evidently, that means that these are nutrients that may or may not be found in our natural diet, or they, she said, they may be needed in much larger doses than you can get at the drugstore with a multivitamin, for instance, trace minerals, for instance. She said you can have much, much higher doses of trace minerals in order to bring about mental health. But she said even schizophrenia, which in my mind has always been sort of, you can't touch that. Once you're schizophrenic, it's done. You always are schizophrenic and there's no real treatment. You just have to live with it and hope you're not too schizophrenic. She was saying even that's not the case in all cases. So I was just thinking about that and the fact that we're talking about things we take into our bodies in lots of different ways, including the cigarettes and the drink and everything. Do you work with that with your patients? Do you, first of all, you're a psychologist, so you can't medicate, right? You don't have an MD.
That's correct.
Yeah. So do you work with a psychiatrist who can medicate if you think a patient needs it?
Yeah, that's, it's changed a lot over the years. It used to be that I could have a relationship with different psychiatrists and work as a team, but then the way the insurance industry has evolved, that's not feasible anymore. So I just have to send these people back to their insurance company so that they can find a psychiatrist that their insurance company will reimburse and then, mm-hmm. you know, just try. It is very difficult. It's rare these days that psychiatrists will actively engage in feedback about, you know, the welfare of their patient. But it's, you know, that's the goal. And you and I have had a conversation or two about this before, but I would really enjoy helping you question the thoroughly false belief you have and you share with so many others, that schizophrenia is a diagnosis that once it's given means that person has that for the rest of their lives, and they just have to hope they don't have it as badly as most people do, et cetera. Because schizophrenia, like every other diagnosis, is just a word. And
right. Well, I would...
It is often given as a it's often given as a diagnosis very, very quickly when there's been any kind of a psychotic break or episode.
Mm-hmm.
And that is not useful for most people. It's expedient for a hospital or a psychiatrist or somebody prescribing medications, but it's not in the individual's best interest, and it's not anything like the belief system that has grown up around that word. And I've worked with a number of patients over the years who've had that diagnosis, and after some time in therapy and working with, you know, either titrating down or changing medications or getting off medications and really learning about their own system, they no longer have any of the signs and symptoms that would give them that diagnosis.
That's so fabulous to hear, because the two people I've known in my life, well, actually it's three, two of them are, let's see, are they, they're all relatives in my extended family. One who came schizophrenic, or it became full-blown when she was in college and died at age 67, having spent her whole life in a mental hospital, where it was an excellent place in New Hampshire. She got great care, but she never came back to reality in a way that she could function on the outside world. And two other relatives, quite close relatives, who seem to be in trouble that way too. So my experience has been that it's a done deal. I love hearing that it isn't. And I'm wondering what we missed. Did we not take care of them properly? Or
okay, stop.
Okay.
You're talking about something you can never know. You're talking about the past. Let's just focus on the present moment. What can you learn about the people that are alive in your life today and signs and symptoms they might have and or diagnoses they may have gotten, and what you might learn about different treatments that might benefit them?
Mm-hmm.
I've had the privilege of at least two people that I've interviewed in the past couple of years who had the diagnosis of schizophrenia and were hospitalized and loaded up with medications and came out the other side. And they no longer have the diagnosis, and they don't live on medications, and they're high functioning. We're talking about one of them is an attorney who fights for victims' rights or for mental health rights. Another one is a psychologist. And you know, those interviews are there to be had. Those people's stories are there to be heard and learned from. They're on journeystream.org/podcast. And Ron Bassman is a psychologist. And the other gentleman's name will come to me, but he's, I think it's Keith something. He's an attorney in Alaska. Psych Rights, RITRIGHTS.org is his website.
Mm-hmm.
And they both had severe psychosis. They could not tell up from down where they were, right from wrong, et cetera. And they got hospitalized, and they got loaded up with very caustic treatments, harmful treatments, and they came through it. And they put together a healthy, productive, high-level lifestyle. And that's just two examples. There, as I mentioned, I've lost track of how many in my caseload over the years where people have had a diagnosis of, you know, psychosis or schizophrenia, and over time, with good therapy, with dietary change, with staying away from alcohol and drugs, with getting proper sleep and learning, you know, different techniques they can do like meditation, you know, dealing with the traumas in their lives and the effects of past traumas that would come up and spark them, teaching them coping mechanisms, they function in the world, and they no longer have any of the symptoms that would get them the label of schizophrenic or manic depressive, or the list goes on and on.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that nobody has that problem. and that there is no such thing as schizophrenia. What it means is many, many people are given that diagnosis way too early, and they're limited to these psychopharmacological treatments that are more harmful than good in the long term. So I just wanted to point out that if there's something I can do to help you question that negative and, I believe, quite false belief about how anybody who is schizophrenic is that way for life, and they're going to get worse and worse until they die, and they just have to hope that they're not going to be one of the worst case scenarios, that is a fantasy. Mm-hmm. That is something that was perpetuated by a system that is, that we're learning more and more year by year how broken the system itself is.
Yeah. Well, I am convinced by what I listened to one of those podcasts. I don't remember which it was. And also the man who headed up or is front and center with Journey's Dream had mental health problems that he overcame, too. I don't remember his name either. It's not Rex.
His name is Mark Hattis.
Okay. Very
and
impressive.
He had multiple hospitalizations. He had the diagnosis of manic depressive. He had a classic presentation and lots of turbulence, a very rough ride for probably several years. And he had high intelligence. He had a desire to find an alternative way to address the problems. And he addressed the problems. I mean, he spent considerable amount of time, intelligence, money, and energy changing his lifestyle, learning about his body, learning about his thought process, using the Michael Rice-type tools, going to doctors that helped him radically change his gut biome health and his nutritional supplements. It's a package deal. And not everybody who has that has those kinds of resources. And yet those are the kinds of resources that we hope one day our insurance company will make available. Right now, insurance will only pay for the meds.
Yeah.
Or what is, considered the conventional approach.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot in each of these stories.
Mm.
And if you look at just the three stories we mentioned, the Ron Bassman and the gentleman who's the attorney in Alaska and Mark Hattis, you're going to see three very different stories. These aren't three identical people. And there were different contributing factors to the psychosis or the manic depressive episode or the thing that they would diagnose as schizophrenia and the treatments. So it's most effective to view every individual as just that, an individual person.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got their family history. I mean, today I was talking to somebody again. This is such an important topic. Michael Rice talks about it as the scriptural quote that says, the sins of the father will be passed, yea, unto three and four generations. And then Michael usually goes into some level of discussion about how the word sin here simply means energy that's off the mark.
Right?
This is not a moral judgment against one person or another because they did a certain behavior. In this work, sin means an energy that's off the mark. So the energy that's off the mark gets passed unto three and four generations. And when you think about it, where did the people four generations back in my bloodline get their energies that they're passing down from three and four generations back? So it's an endless loop. It goes back to the origins of my bloodline. And it isn't just a sperm and an egg that get passed along. It's the energetic impressions of the whole bloodline. So, I had a person in my office today who's had a lot of benefit from this work over the years, but he keeps having problems with physical aches and pains and violent thoughts. And so I spent the second half of the session today talking to him about a variety of things, like the book by Mark Wolin that's titled It Didn't Start With You, and the idea
right.
that these energies get passed through the bloodline and they have nothing to do with your direct experience. So there's a story of the young woman that was seeing me, and she was in her 20s, and she had tremendously high anxiety and a fear of being in closed spaces and lots of vivid, violent thoughts. And she, you know, she hated the violent thoughts. She never wanted to be harmful to anybody, et cetera. And yet these things just kept happening. So after we did the usual worksheet process and EFT tapping and breath work and the neuroemotional technique, and she was stuck with very intense anxiety, I had a talk with her one session about how this stuff gets passed down the bloodline. And she went home and asked her aunt and talked with her grandmother, and she came back eyes as big as saucers. How did you know? And I said, how did I know what? She said, well, this fear of being, you know, stuck in an elevator or something like that, apparently it comes because my great-grandmother on one side was buried alive. And this pattern of violent thoughts, apparently just one generation back, two generations back, not her mother, but her grandmother, witnessed unspeakable violence because of the business the family was involved in, et cetera. And so no wonder she has all of these violent thoughts, because it was in the bloodline. And it got not something that she witnessed as a child, not something that her mother witnessed as a child, but something her grandmother lived through. And so as I mentioned that to the person who I was having the session with today, he erupts with stuff I had never heard from him before. He's got a nephew who's in prison for murder. He's got an uncle who had the death sentence and it was commuted, but now he's in prison for life for violently killing, more than one person. And this is his aunt's brother, or, you know, his aunt's son. So it would be a direct cousin of his, and then one is his nephew. It's on different sides of the family. So he has this in his bloodline from both sides of the family. Lots of violence, lots of physical ailments and injuries, and very, very high anxiety. And if he doesn't accept that it might have origins outside what his direct memory of life experience is, then he's not going to be able to address it. He's not going to have the flexibility in how he uses the tools and applies them to get the most benefit from it. So, wherever you are, whatever you're dealing with, please open yourself to the possibility that it isn't a simple, hey, maybe this happened to me when I was in fifth grade, or maybe my three early memories of conflict exercise from the whyagain.org website is going to reveal something. It might need me to write, and I was suggesting this to the patient today, he might write a letter. I forgot to mention, he knows that his father's father killed somebody with his bare hands. So he might write a letter to his grandfather about how he's got all of these violent thoughts and he keeps thinking about, you know, doing harm to people that he doesn't want to do. So he could write the letter to his grandfather and just imagine that he's handing it back to his grandfather. Matt Kahn said this in one of his talks. He said, just imagine that you're handing these energies and these issues back to the person, if it's your grandfather or your great-grandfather, and you're lovingly returning it to them so they can work through it and they can move on in their healing journey. It doesn't have to be a blame letter. It doesn't have to be full of vengeance or disgust. We're all just people doing the best we can. And if I become aware that these energies that I'm experiencing, intense emotions and life experiences, that they may have their roots in the life of somebody higher, farther back in my bloodline, I can lovingly envision handing them this issue and saying, thanks, but no thanks. I'm going to return this to you so you can work at it at your cause level and move forward in your journey. And as it arises in me in the future, I'm just going to keep lovingly sending it back to you. And that can be the beginning of changing my perceptual experience when those thoughts and energies arise.
It's amazing
Go ahead. It's amazing that even what?
Even the acknowledgement of something has an effect before you even hand it back. Just uncovering it seems to have a healing effect.
Sure. What am I doing with my mind energy when I think, oh, my God, I just had this horrible, violent thought. What is wrong with me? What do I do with my mind energy?
Right.
I create a conclusion that I'm damaged or broken. Or that I might be a serial killer, that I have to try and marshal the awareness to constantly monitor my thoughts so I don't let this slip out. And imagine what I'm doing. Remember how Michael talks about how our thought is a creative force. Our ability to originate mind energy has its own level of creation attached to it. So what am I doing when I reach a conclusion like that that says, oh, my God, I can't believe I had this horrible thought. What is wrong with me? What if I just watch it as a movement of mind energy and I understand that we're all connected? And within just the last 3 or 4 generations in my bloodline alone, I've had probably 8 to 12 people who've been involved in wars. What would they have seen and heard and...
I know.
And so it's as natural as breathing that I might have a violent thought. What I do with it, how I interpret it and choose to respond to it, has the bulk of the creative power in my life. If I give it an emotional response like, oh, my God, that's horrible, and I can't stand that, and I will never have that thought again, what do I do in my energy system? I create an experience, I intensify it, and I lock it down in my system.
Right.
What if I just open up to the fact that, hey, it's just energy. It's just a thought. It's okay. I soften, I breathe, I don't add all of that negative energy to it. I change the experience of it.
That's just what Pam Grout was talking about in her lesson today. And I sent out, we have a Zoom meeting tomorrow, and I send them a little quote or a teaser or something. And what I sent out today is just the thought, you are not your thoughts. I am not my thoughts. But you've helped me understand that not only are we not our thoughts, but our thoughts aren't ours. I mean, it goes both ways. Where did that thought come from? It's not me, but it might be somebody else's or something else. Wow. Anyway, yeah. Yeah, just I had a grandfather who was put in an orphanage, and I had been having just day-long bouts of anxiety. And somebody on the show, maybe it was you, suggested, you know, who's back there? Who went through what? And I thought, well, my grandfather had a very bad time. I wonder if I should confer with him. And I've told you about this before. And so I just imagined he was talking to me, and he told me how absolutely horrendous and frightened he was, and how sad he was that he was the youngest of 13 kids. Father left home. He felt useless, and he was he felt unwanted. I'm sure he was wanted, but they couldn't care for him, or his mother couldn't put him in this orphanage where he spent 7 years, I think. Yep, from 5 to 12. And I didn't do any processing that I was aware of, but I've never had that, knock on wood, superstition sets in. I've never had that anxiety since. I've had little swoons of anxiety about this and that, but nothing like that. It just dissolved it like a chemical reaction.
It's wonderful.
And just having the realization that Grandpa was in trouble, and what was I doing with it? I was carrying it. Why? I don't know. How? I don't know. Wasn't a conscious carrying. So mysterious. We are so mysterious.
And that just because it's outside my conscious logical or what I would perceive and register as physical doesn't mean it's not real. Right? It can be very real. And so let me wake up to that possibility. Let me soften and breathe and throw the door open and say, I'm going to allow this to be here, and I'm going to dismantle any attachment I have, like in the form of identification. Like, oh, I am this person who has all these violent thoughts, or I mm-hmm. am this person who is so highly anxious that I can't function, etc. I'm going to dissolve, once I recognize those, dissolve my attachment to those identifications and allow myself to just breathe, soften, and use all the tools that I might find in the tool chest that Dr. Michael Rice and Jeannie make available, or the Byron Katie work where I wake up and realize, hey, you know what? I only suffer when I believe my thoughts.
When
I practice this idea of questioning everything, every thought, it shifts. It's like you said, like the chemical reaction, the impact fades away. Okay, well, I'm all for that. I'd like to have this fade away.
Mm.
So I'll start to question.
Boy, that brings up a whole pile of other questions. Oh.
Like what?
Well, I'm working with a man who has been complaining and telling the same story for years and years and years. And at one point, we stopped working together. I said, I need some space from this because it seems as if whatever I find to be the best of the tools, you're not using these tools, and there's a lot of resistance here. And why don't you take some time and get in touch with me when you want to work again? And he very readily accepted that. So he came back, but it's the same thing again. And he won't use the tools. He really wants to blame but... You know, he's in a very bad shape. He wants his life to, he's complaining about his wife. He's got a mentally ill daughter. He hates his job, a lot of stuff, but he won't use whatever I have that's the best. And so I say to him, okay, I actually invoke Tim Hayes. I say, okay, I love the way you say that. Okay. Yeah. And then, I think I have to stop working with him again. And I've got to do worksheets on allowing him to, what it appears to be, is getting nowhere. But here's a man who's mentally healthy, not schizophrenic, or it seems as if the resources he has could lead him to vigorous, good mental health, but he's not doing it. But I wouldn't say he's anything more than just depressed or disgusted or choosing a dark view of life. And I don't know what he's doing with his micronutrients or his exercise. I'm sure he gets plenty of exercise. He's industrious. But so I'm just, I guess I'm presenting you with a big mess with one of my clients that I'm stuck with. Yeah, stuck on.
Well, you know, what you do with that, it's going to be okay, whatever you decide to do. You know, we've had a conversation before about what I do when I run into one of those situations. And most often what I do is I start discussing it with somebody and talk about how it's my experience that they're not making progress and asking them if they think otherwise. Right. So if they think they are making progress and they can tell me what that progress is and or which tools that I've suggested or they found on their own that they're using, then I might be convinced and continue to keep going with them. But if on the other hand, you know, they aren't able to convince me that this is helping them significantly, I start to explore the possibility of firing them, if you call it that, or referring them to somebody else, or suggesting that they go find somebody else, or even suggesting that they take a break from therapy for a while because they're in this pattern of coming to weekly sessions or, you know, every other week session, whatever the frequency is, and they're believing that they're getting therapy. When my understanding is they're not getting therapy because they're not doing anything between sessions, which is furthering their work. And so I don't want to participate in the charade of doing therapy and let them think, well, I'm in therapy. I'm on my therapist, you know, when I know what they're doing is not therapy. What they're doing is coming in and treating me like a friend or a gossip board, and they're batting away everything I would recommend that they try or any change that they might affect in their life. And so, you know, at a certain point, I will give them a chance to convince me otherwise. And if not, I'll simply say, I'm not interested in helping you create the fantasy that you're working to make your life better.
That's so interesting. I've never thought of it like that. I have understood myself to be a person who is supposed to deliver sympathy and agreement with him. So corroborating his story and telling him that, yes, you're a victim and you deserve to get retribution, which I don't do. So I just come to the edge there and I say, these are the things that will, I guarantee you, will work, but you have to do them, whereas he's expecting other people to do for him, and then he'll be ready to get well. It, you know, it's he's given his power away over and over and over again, but that's very interesting to take that line of questions that you just, that's helpful. I'm going to do that with him. Yeah.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call, and we've reached the end of our hour, so I will mute you so you can listen into the second hour if that's your desire. Thank you again for participating.
Thanks,
good to hear
Dr.
from
Ted.
You. All right.
Thanks.
Blessings.
Thanks.
I'll remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim.
What's the health update?
Well, I haven't heard from the doctor yet. I got to FaceTime with Dad a while ago, and he looks better. I ran a fever again last night, so I don't know if it's a back up or a go forward, but I definitely feel better than I did. But and I think Michael's probably 97% better. So, and they're talking about letting Dad come home. It's just a matter of, you know, if I can get home care to be here to help me until I get totally back on my feet. So.
All right. Well, blessings to all of you. And
thank you.
I hope it resolves quickly and well for everyone, and have a wonderful show.
Thank you. Thank you. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. Today is Tuesday, December the 21st, 2021, and our calling number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. Give Michael just a minute to get dialed in. And I apologize. I don't know what happened except that I was working on the website with Fog Brain, and I messed up our homepage. So I've written to Susan Giles, who has our domain server. And I said, help. I said, help me straighten this back out. I don't know what I did. So if you go to whyagain.org, you're liable to land on the Coptic conference page or something else. And she's trying to get it straightened out for me. So I guess I'll quit doing updates until I get my bearings back. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, sweetheart. And that has been part of the impact the last 5 or 6 days of this whole COVID thing, is a little bit of foggy brain and the need for rest. That's probably been one of the biggest things, aside from just taking care of ourselves, breathing and doing the work. So, in a sense, kind of appreciating the opportunity to dig in and do the work that COVID has given. And appreciating the fact that there'll be a natural immunity that comes from this interaction, and holding the space for so many people who are suffering just around everything that's going on in the culture. So holding each and every one of you in our hearts, and sending love. Beyond that, I'm going to jump right into the book. Why is this happening to me again? It's almost the end of the year, so we're coming up to the completion point of the conversation about forgiveness in this format. And if you're following along with us, we're on page 169 in the book. And we're looking at the importance. And one of the big challenges of forgiveness, and I certainly understand why people didn't understand it. I mean, it took me decades working with this to understand why would I do such a silly-ass thing as cancel a perfectly good goal? Gee, here I am. I just want this person to, fulfill their promise to me. That's a reasonable thing, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. But then, Michael, I'm really enraged at them because they haven't kept my promise. I mean, they really have made me so mad because they didn't keep their word to me. So why would I cancel a perfectly good goal for them to keep their promise? Well, you'll notice that unless you're just a generally miserable person, you're pretty happy with most everybody when they're doing what it is you want them to do for you. When they're fulfilling your goals, like, taking care of their promise to you. And it's a reasonable thing if somebody makes a promise to me for them to keep that promise. So I'm certainly justified in demanding that of them, right? Oh, absolutely, you are. But here's the problem. You want to be able to keep a sane mind while you're doing it. And if you load a goal for somebody to keep the promises to you, and your mind is going berserk in rage or fear or pain or loss or whatever it is, you have a problem. Well, of course I have a problem, Michael. They're not paying me what they said they'd pay me. Well, that's really not your problem. Your problem is your rage, your fear, your sadness, your grief, whatever there is in the file in your mind on people keeping their promises to you. problem is. So we're going to suggest if you have a goal for somebody to do something and you find yourself an upset, you're not canceling the goal because there's something wrong with the goal. Perfectly good goal. I mean, everybody should have the goal for everybody in their lives to always fulfill their promises. That's very reasonable. It's not the goal, it's the problem. It's the fact that when you load that goal in your mind, that goal recruits from your unconscious the pain, the rage, the fear, the guilt, the grief, whatever it is that's going on in you. It's the goal that recruits or sets that through resonance in motion. So when you say, I have all this rage at them for not fulfilling their promises, what I know is in the file in your mind on promises being fulfilled, you've got rage. Now, that might mean that, and what you might ultimately process when you collapse the pained perception from that file, what you might process, what you might go through when you cancel that goal and that perception collapses is the memory of maybe being three when, dad promised you something, didn't fulfill his promise, and you whine and you cried. When you whine and you cried, you got beaten mercilessly for it. And a power person dynamic was installed in the mind of the three-year-old because, one, this dad had more power over you than you did over your life. Two, dad was not functioning as love. And three, at three, being beaten like that, you perceived it as survival. Perceiving as survival, you opened your field wide to draw in, to just like a vacuum cleaner, suck in everything that was in the environment, all of that rage, all of that pain. So that energy from that experience of a three-year-old, wherever it's stored in your physiology, is your disease, and is ultimately what will literally, physiologically, if you're going to die, kill you. Because that quality of energy doesn't belong anywhere in the tissue structure. And if it's stored in your heart, then you're going to have heart problems. If it's stored in your liver, you're going to have liver problems. If it's stored in your lung, or if it's stored in your big toe, you're going to have problems wherever that energy is stored. So when you cancel the goal, you don't cancel the goal, perfectly good goal, because there's something wrong with it. You cancel because you recognize every time you load that goal, your mind serves up something that holds pain for you. And pain is a signal that your thinking is in error and that there's a disintegrative energy somewhere in your tissue structure. So you cancel the goal because the surface mind's perception, the projection that they made me feel this way, collapses, and you get to the root of why you're feeling that way. And it might be that three-year-old experience, and it might be something that goes back 30 generations in your bloodline. And if it goes back 30 generations in your bloodline, canceling the goal just once for somebody to keep their promises probably isn't going to clean that out of your mind or out of your body. You know, I said, Yeshua, how many of these darn worksheets do we have to do? Is seven enough? In Aramaic, Yeshua's answer was no, 77 times 70. In other words, you'll do an infinite amount of work till you're finished with cleaning out that which causes your pain. So forgiveness becomes the tool for removing painful energetic patterns from your tissue structure. It's got nothing to do with the Greek idea of letting other people off the hook. And I understand why it degraded to, I'm going to let you off the hook because the pain is in me. 3.5 decades of working with that to finally comprehend this simple explanation. You cancel a goal because if you load a goal in your mind and that mind resonates some form of hostility or fear, you're in deep trouble and you want to clean up that part of your mind. Forget about this thing of letting other people off the hook. Never forgive anybody for anything. You say, yeah, I need to forgive myself. Never forgive yourself for anything. You cancel a goal because the goal is a driver of your perception. If your perception has integrated into it some form of hostility or fear, there's a disease moving in you, and you want to clean up your disease. That's why forgiveness. Forgiveness is about removing those dis-ease patterns. So our character, Richard, is on step six, and he's answering the question, what I really want. He's doing a worksheet around an issue with his younger sister, who in his world always got treated well when he got puked on. And you want to use words that represent what you really want, because through resonance, that's how you open the part of the mind that holds the disintegrative energy. So his goal in this situation with his sister is to be loved and appreciated and cared for as much as Amy. His perception as a child was Amy had it good and I got puked on. Richard agreed that he could see a difference in the energy he was now putting out with two different thoughts about what he wanted. He was particularly impressed by the change in the way he felt when he switched back and forth from what he wanted to the avoidance thought, I don't want to be angry with Amy. I'm amazed as I pay attention, Richard said, how each of those thoughts affect the way I feel. You said I would be more sensitive to my feelings if I refrained from smoking and drinking coffee. Could it be that much of a shift in my awareness after leaving nicotine and caffeine alone for just a few hours? You know, I'm just realizing I read this yesterday. We're doubling up. Well, maybe we need to double up on these ideas. Could there be that much of a difference, he inquired. I let him know, I thought. It could make the difference. But it was probably a combination of factors, including the fact that we'd previously processed through a lot of emotion, and cleared lots of baggage out of his mind in the mini-intensive we were doing. And we're heading in. I actually went to the incorrect page here, so my error, excuse me. We had finished up step eight yesterday, so we're heading to step nine. Step nine is the core of the forgiveness process. Write your answer, what you want from step six, into the blank in step nine. Recall in Aramaic, the word forgive means to cancel. Can you cancel the people in your life? Can you cancel your life? Can you cancel today? No, but you can always cancel what you want out of a situation. Doing this sets your mind to process through the unconsciousness around your worksheet issue. So number 9A, I cancel. We've had him transfer his answer from number 6 directly to 9A in this particular worksheet. I cancel, let go of my need to be loved and appreciated and cared for as much as my sister Amy. Richard balked a little at doing this. Why would I cancel what I want? You said that yourself. I deserve to have that. Canceling your need for what you want opens the space for you to see your own blocks. You do deserve to have what you ask for. And I acknowledge you as a powerful creator. Why haven't you created what you want yet? Well, I don't know, he stammered. No one has ever cared for me and appreciated me the way I wanted to be. It's always been the problem out of my relationships with women. They're affectionate for a while, and then they become distant. I'm not sure I quite understand it yet, but I cancel my need to be loved, appreciated, and cared for as much as my sister. Is it possible, Richard, that you acquired that belief when you were a child? Did your actions with women drive them away And is that what caused intimacy to disappear? The result you produce is that you get to prove over and over again that you're not lovable. Tears were flowing from Richard's eyes as, once again, feelings welled up from deep inside of him. A quiet sob filled the room as he spoke. Why am I not lovable? What's wrong with me? Feels like I've never known what it is to feel loved. So I've become calloused, I realize, in order not to feel the pain. It seems so deep, like a dark hole that can never be filled. I can now see why I tend to intellectualize. It's been a way of avoiding feeling this. Keep breathing, I suggested gently. You're accessing hidden places in yourself. Places that your personality structure keeps you out of awareness. Pardon you, helps you to keep out of awareness. It is safe to access those places and move what is locked within. Remember to hold the space of love. That is where healing happens. And step 9B, you get a chance to ask for assistance in moving through, comes to the surface as you forgive. So what do you mean? Well, there's a power in Aramaic that is called Rukhida Kudsha. It is defined as an elemental force in the mind that assists you in letting go of your errors and teaches you the truth. It literally means the force for that which is proper for us as humans. The inner power has been known by many names: the higher power, the Holy Spirit, the superconscious, the superprocessor. That's why there's a blank, where I encourage you to address that power with whatever name is comfortable to you. How about going ahead and asking for that assistance? He spoke the next step out loud and grew very silent. I invite Rukha to incline me toward healing, to restore me to love, to assist me in keeping love present, and to help in letting go of my painful reality. What's happening, Richard? Are you breathing? I'm really feeling sad, overwhelming sadness and loss. And at the same time, it's kind of a good sadness, if such a thing is possible. It almost feels like being washed. There's an energy running through my hands, and my face is a little numb. I'm realizing that when I was a kid, I blame my sister for how I was treated by my parents. Seems like I've been really unfair to her. I take it out on her all her life, and she was just a beautiful little kid. She didn't deserve what I've done to her and what I've continued to do to her all our lives. I've treated her like she was a nobody. The same thing I've accused my parents and women of doing to me all my life. Sounds like you could easily turn the abuse you've done to her on yourself. I suggest you be aware of that and live the commitment of being loving, gentle, and respectful with yourself. It doesn't feel like I deserve it. I hate myself. I've been pretty rotten to her. He was in self-pity. So you've just uncovered your next few worksheets, Richard. I suggest you make a note for your journal and fill in step 1A on some blank worksheets. You would benefit from worksheets on deserving, on self-hate, on being rotten. I think self-pity would also be a productive topic in which you could do worksheets. I invite you to remember that the purpose of delving into these areas of your life is to recognize what you have done to yourself and others with your mind energy. One of the games of the human mind, the non-being mind, is to always reproduce its patterns and make the behavior connected with those patterns look like a justifiable action. What I hear is that your reality, quote, someone is to blame and punishment is in order, has been resonated. And now that you see your sister's innocence, you're about to turn that reality on yourself. Remember, Richard, you are innocent too. So Richard's starting to get a look at the way he moves from abuse of others to the way he could easily move to abuse of self. And it's such a typical dynamic in the world. A really major piece of work to do to clean that one up. And recognizing the innocence that resides within each and every one of us. When we buy into this guilty self, this pained self, then what happens is we tend to play out what we believe we deserve based on an errant understanding of life. You know, usually the understanding of a child. And we play those things out because they're so lost in the history of the mind that most people, they just can't even fathom that it's there. And to me, I mean, I feel so blessed by the fact that we have gotten to understand and uncover what the first century Aramaic Yeshua was actually teaching people about the healing process. And the genius that's there is just so monumental. And it's really sad and crazy that because so many people have been abused by those who didn't understand and pretend that they did, that they throw out a monumentally healing teaching because of the prejudices they've developed. And so that's our reading for today, and we now are at about the 1:22 point in our radio show. Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
It is all quiet. So someone press one. We have 36 minutes.
Yeah, let's have a conversation. How can we support you? What's on your mind? Came across a cute post on Facebook this morning. Someone's posting a note to Santa Claus and says, Santa Claus, I want a big fat bank account and a slim trim body. Please don't get it backwards like you did last year. And so we hope that St. Nicholas is good to you this year, that your Christmas is healthy, happy. If there are physical challenges in it, we're here to support you and moving through those challenges and processing whatever needs to be processed to get to the highest states of health and wholeness and well-being possible. You know, we're coming up on a season where, you know, people tend to think the word Christ is the name of a man, but if you go back and study it a little bit, it's not the name of a man at all. It's the name of an office. There was never a man, Jesus Christ. First of all, his name was Yeshua. It wasn't Jesus. And secondly, Christ was the office that he held. It wasn't his name. So, you know, example let's say, if you ran for mayor and you won the election and became the mayor of the town, I would call you Mayor Bill or Harry or Mary or whatever. That wouldn't mean that mayor was your name. It's the title of the office that you hold. You remember they talked about in the scriptures, the mind of Christ in you. That word Christ literally in Aramaic means the buttered one or the anointed one. One who had awakened to the truth of who they are and was truly functioning as a human being was called the Christed One. And so this whole celebration coming up in just a week or so is about celebrating that mind in each and every individual, that it is our birthright to live in that mind of love. And the whole body of tools that we have developed are about how to achieve that possibility in your life, that you live from the mind of love and that you literally take responsibility for and process through all fear, rage, hostility, grief, pain, drama, or trauma until the only thing left in you is that presence of love. And if we can support you in any way, shape, or form, if you're listening on a station that we don't have in our control panel, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you'll be listening to the show. And then if you push 1, you and I will be having a conversation. And the monologue part of the show is over. We're ready for dialogue, interaction. And so
I think I'll read
that
someone posted on Facebook to parents who need to tell the truth about Santa. And
oh, cool. That was cute.
So the son says, Dad, I think I'm old enough now. Is there a Santa Claus? Dad, okay, I agree that you're old enough, but before I tell you, I have a question for you. You see, the truth is a dangerous gift. Once you know something, you can't unknow it. So once you know the truth about Santa Claus, you will never again understand or relate to him as you do now. So my question is, are you sure you want to know? There was a brief pause, and he says, yes, I want to know. The dad says, okay, I'll tell you. Yes, there is a Santa Claus. Really? Yes, really. But he's not an old man with a beard and a red suit. That's just what we tell kids. You see, kids are too young to understand the true nature of Santa Claus, so we explain it to them in a way that they can understand. The truth about Santa Claus is that he's not a person at all. He's an idea. Think of all of those presents Santa gave you over the years. I actually bought those myself. I watched you open them. And did it bother me that you didn't thank me? Of course not. Pleasure. You see, Santa Claus is the idea of giving for the sake of giving without the thought of thanks or acknowledgement. When I saw that woman collapse on the subway last week and I called for help, I knew that she would never know that it was me that summoned the ambulance. I was being Santa Claus when I did that. Oh, the son said. So now that you know, you're part of it. You have to be Santa Claus too now. That means you can never tell a young kid the secret, and you have to help us select Santa presents for them. And most important, you have to look for opportunities to help people. Got it? Help each other this Christmas and be kind.
Sweet. Powerful way to explain the principle. So if you're out there in listener land, push 1. Let's have a conversation. How can we support you? We've got about a half hour left. Tying in with what you just shared, Jeannie, there's a... another story, or actually a bit of history that I think I'll share, ties right in. There are a group of Native Europeans called, just looking through the article. Let me just read from the top. It's powerful. Regardless of what spiritual path you walk, remember it's always about love. And this is by a person named J.C. Husfelt, H-U-S-F-E-L-T. At this time of year, the winter solstice, a patriarchal theft by the church is revealed by the concept of Father Christmas. It was stolen from indigenous shamanic cultures, primarily from Siberia and the Nordic countries of northern Norway, Finland, Lapland, and the Arctic Circle. Long before Santa and his flying steeds, it was the female reindeer who drew the sleigh of the sun goddess at the winter solstice. It was when the pagan traditions of winter were Christianized that Father Christmas was born. It was never Father Christmas. Gifts and the return of light at the winter solstice. It was Mother Christmas, the ancient deer mother of old, deer being D-E-E-R. It was she who once flew through the winter's longest, darkest night with the life-giving light of the sun in her horns. And from the British Isles, Scandinavia, Russia, Siberia, across the land bridge of the Bering Strait, she was a revered spiritual figure associated with fertility, motherhood, regeneration, and the rebirth of the sun, which is the theme of the winter solstice. Her antlers adorned shrines and altars, were buried in ceremonial graves, and were worn as shamanic headdresses. The way we saw that pair of antlers worn in a recent insanity in the culture is such a shame to these shamanic traditions. Her image was etched in standing stones, woven into ceremonial cloth and clothing, cast in jewelry, painted on drums, and tattooed onto skin. Reindeer were often shown leaping or flying through the air, with neck outstretched and legs flung fore and aft. Her antlers were frequently depicted as the tree of life, carrying birds, the sun, the moon, and the stars. And across the northern world, it was the deer mother who took flight from the dark of the old year to bring light and life to the new. Sorry, Rudolph. But the male reindeer shed their antlers in the winter. It's only the doe who retains her antlers, as she is the one who leads the herds in the winter. Ever since the early Neolithic period, the female reindeer was venerated by the northern people. She was the life-giving mother, the leader of the herds upon which they depend for survival. And they followed the reindeer migrations for milk, food, clothing, and shelter. An interesting little aside, the tribe that, one of the tribes that does this is called the Sami, S-A-M-I, from their indigenous residents of the Nordic countries. And what led me actually to this particular piece was another piece I was reading on what's happening in the arena of global warming. The Sami, of course, being from the Arctic Circle and, you know, that region of the world, snow is a pretty important part of their culture, and they literally have 100 different words for snow. You know, it's such an important part of the culture that, you know, if I asked you what kind of snow it was and you used the wrong word, it could cost me my life because I might get the wrong snowshoes out and go out trekking and never come back because I'm not outfitted properly for the snow conditions. Well, the correlating article that I'm speaking of, they were pointing out that today, in this area of the world, with what's happening with global temperature change, is they're seeing a new kind of snow that they don't have a word for. And it's a snow that results from thawing and freezing and thawing and freezing, where normally they would have a frozen tundra the reindeer have sharp hooves that break through the tundra and provide them with food, but that's not happening anymore because of this thawing and freezing and thawing and freezing. It's not snow they have to break through, but it's ice. And once it freezes, because of the warming and the melting, once it freezes, the reindeer are starving because they can't break through the ice. And these local peoples have no word for this kind of snow. It's a new phenomenon that's just shown up. So again, one of these cultures that honored the life-giving mother, the deer mother, was the Sami. For the Sami, the indigenous people of the Nordic countries, Bivi is the name of the sun goddess associated with motherhood, the fertility of plants, and the reindeer. At winter solstice, warm butter, which is a symbol for them of the sun, was smeared on doorposts as a sacrifice to Bivi, so that she could gain strength and fly higher and higher into the sky. Bivi was often shown accompanied by her daughter in an enclosure of reindeer antlers, and together they returned green and fertility to the land. Many other winter goddesses in northern legends were associated with the solstice. They took to the skies, led by a bevy of flying animals. One tells of the return of Sol, the Lithuanian and Latvian goddess of the sun. She flew across the heavens in a sleigh pulled by horned reindeer and threw pebbles of amber, symbolizing the sun, into chimneys. While many historical explorations of the pagan origins of Christmas observe the link between Santa's garb and the red and white amanita mushroom ingesting shamans, few mention that it was the female shamans who originally wore red and white costumes trimmed with fur, horned headdresses, or red felt hats. The ceremonial clothing worn by medicine women healers of Siberia and Lapland was green and white with red peaked hat, curl-toed boots, reindeer mittens, fur lining, and trim. Considering that most of the shamans in this region were originally women, it's likely that the traditional wear is the true source for Santa's costume. It's also very likely that they were the first to take the shamanic flight with the reindeer on winter's darkest night. And, you know, we talk about mindsets. If you were with us when we talked about the Beatitudes a couple of weeks ago, we talked about the opening of each of the Beatitudes. The first word in each Beatitude is tuvehun, and tuv represents an attitude of mind. And if you remember in the Beatitudes when we spoke about that, one of the requirements was a mindset or an attitude of mind of just and fair behavior between people. And you look at how this theft that they're talking about here has occurred and how it continues to occur. You know, it's happening today in America. There's a mindset of, well, I'm going to take more and more and more and more and more, and it doesn't matter what it does to the environment. It doesn't matter what it does to children. It doesn't matter what it does to mothers. It doesn't matter what it does to the rest of the world as long as I've got mine. And that mindset is so unjust and so unfair, it literally threatens the world. If we can get the principles by which the human mind works, and there's nowhere on the planet that I've found these principles so clearly enumerated as the original Aramaic teachings of a man named Yeshua. And when they say to him, what's first in all this law you're telling us? He doesn't say love God, love your neighbor, and love yourself. That's just bunk. He says you've got to have a filter in the frontal lobes of your brain. There's not even a word for it in English, not even a concept. So we're building brain cells right from scratch, but that you keep this filter in the frontal lobes of your brain active. And that results in things like just and fair behavior between people. That results in you having a home in these energetic fields in which we live, move, and have our being. It results in us being empowered to clean up the mindset of such greed. You know, the world is so filled with greed. We could restore these principles to come back to balance. And that's our whole reason for doing what we do with this work and with this show. And we're delighted that you're here to be part of the conversation. Excuse me. Ms. Cheney, do we have anybody out there with a hand up in the phone queue or anything happening in the chat room?
Yes, we have a hand up, and I believe it's Dusty904. You're on the air.
Well, aloha and melekalikamakas to you too and everybody listening. Hi.
Aloha. Wow, your phone sounds good. You must have gotten yourself a new phone.
Well, I patched together an old track phone and got it to work off my internet. And
cool.
I'm quite grateful.
You sound better than any conversation we've had since we started talking on the show. So good work.
I'm so glad because I had certain friends that would just always fuss at me about it, and I would just go through all kinds of things. But anyways, thank you. You both said about three things that just all struck chords with me, and I do have a question, but that last thing about the feminine principle being kind of stepped on, as it were, through time or whatever, and reminds me a little bit of the Ruka Dikudsha, but I am so glad that you brought that up. It kind of ties in, for me personally, my own paradigm, with the Mahashakti in the Sanskrit. It's the divine feminine. And I really like that you brought that up. And also, Jeannie, that thing that you read, it was it was just really beautiful. And I also like I really like the explanation on what people think of Jesus Christ. And I have noticed the same thing, that so many people think it's just a name like Jose Imanez or something, you know, rather than a state of office, or to me, more exactly, the Christ is a state of consciousness. And I thank you for clarifying that for all of us.
Honored and delighted in joining you in developing and opening and living from that mind that's in each and every one of us. That's our birthright to have. And our culture, you know, basically, I mean, the whole culture is set to destroy that in individuals, which is really bizarre when you look at it.
It really is. And it's just so dark and counterproductive. I can't quite understand any. Well, I just don't understand that thinking too well anyway. But also, I wanted to ask you a question. In the paradigm that you work with about more the functioning of the human mind, I guess, where you start with intentions and you go through the three filters of fear, hostility, and Ratma. And then, and this is the part I'm not real clear about why, out of all the almost infinite connections and hookups within the neurology, our own neurology, this one's got a maximum of 9 bits of data designed to light up the life or whatever, be the guide. I'm familiar, you know, I mean, for me, it's been about the power 3 since I was a little kid. Tesla would say that if you knew the power of the 9, 6, and 3, at least he's attributed to saying that, he said you would know the wonders of the world. But why 9 bits to you? Why is that?
Well, Ashley, there's a psychologist back in the 50s that did some research at Harvard University on the capacity of the mind. And I don't necessarily, because there's other research that varies with that, but I kind of metaphorically call our perceptual construct the 9-bit mind. And what this psychologist came up with, and it's actually some of the most quoted research in all of psychology, this particular piece of information, and what they said was that in a time frame where, you know, if they were hooked someone's brain up to electrodes, there were 10,000 brain cells firing, the maximum space, the maximum capacity of conscious awareness was 9 bits of that 10,000 brain cells firing.
Oh, so it's related to the consciousness.
What they determined as, at least the best understanding I have, is conscious capacity. Now, there's other research that says maybe it's 12 bits or it's 14 bits. I'm not hung up on the literal 9 bits, but the point to me is that when you realize that we're seeing just the tiniest tip of the iceberg, if there are 10,000 brain cells firing and we're seeing 9 or 12 or 15 or 200 or 2,000, you know, it's minuscule compared to what's actually moving in us. And then what's moving in us is minuscule compared to what's actually present energetically in the environment. And so to me, the principle, the reason why I focus on that idea of the 9-bit mind, is that we get to recognize how limited our perceptual constructs are, and that there's a quality to them. And on a scale of 1 to 10, if you're living with a level 10 perception, you're considered a genius. If you're living with a level 1 perception, you're considered a moron. And, you know, so there are qualities of perception. A lot of people don't realize that. You know, they think, well, everybody looks out and they see the same world and they're just looking at the world. And the truth is we're not. We're looking at a perceptual construct. And to me, one of the gifts of Yeshua from 2,000 years ago was to show people how to improve the quality of their perceptual constructs so they became more capable, more intelligent, more able in every arena, because they were working with a higher quality. You know, it'd be like, you know, you as an engineer, and I can think back, you know, I used to be in the studio business, and I can remember when the recording studio was 8-track, and then it went to 62, and then, God, I don't even know what it's at today, doing a 100-track studio. Obviously, if somebody's working in an 8-track studio and getting a product out of it, gee, it sounds pretty good, but it's nothing like they can mix out of a 16-track studio, and then nothing compared to what they could do with a 100-track studio. And then, you know, another good comparison, today a lot of people listen to CDs, and CDs sample sound, but they don't actually ever serve up what the, like, you know, if we record an orchestra, a CD has just like the smallest fragment of what's actually contained there. That's why audiophiles, like something that's coming back big time, is pressed wax records, because a record can give you a thousand times more information than the sampling of a CD. And it's kind of the same thing. If you're an audiophile and you're listening to a record that analog, as you say, compared to the digital, there's like, just monumental amounts of data available that isn't available in the digital world. And in the same way, the 9-bit mind, there's a monumental amount of data that's missing until we start to get it on track and correct it. And that's what I see in all the study I've done over the last 50 years. Yeshua was a master at showing people how to get that thing back on track. And then they turned it into a religion.
Right, right. Well, that kind of makes sense, but and it really, to me, really speaks to the human condition of how little in the vastness of, oh God, you know, the universes or creation or whatever, how little piece of the pie we really operate with. Once in a while, well, actually, when I meditate every day and I go into my own neurology, I seem to feel like I get more for at least a while, but
right.
There have been times in my life that I've been gifted with a quick little boop view of a way bigger picture, and
right.
I'm going, oh, my goodness, that makes my 9 bits or whatever you want to say about it. It's sort of like the a pimple on a gnat's butt in a faraway universe. I mean, that's about how
right,
important
exactly.
or how earth-shattering
yeah.
that is, that I am or whatever. And yet we walk around with our 9 bits thinking that me, often. And the Dalai Lama years ago set me free from my own striving in a particular way when he said, just in a kind of a laughing tone of voice, you know, like the guy does, and he said, there's a whole lot more that we don't know than we do. Well, while that
no.
might seem obvious, yeah, you know what I mean? It was like, oh, well, good, then I don't have to try to know more than I don't. And but 9 bits, I get it. I get what you're saying about that. And, oh, my goodness. Boy, that's limited. 10,000 to 9
well,
or whatever it is.
Yeah. And then when you recognize that the 9 bits that's firing in the mind, by the fact that it's firing the mind means it's already there, which means it's from the past. So now what is the 9-bit mind doing but replicating its past? You know, go back 2,000 years ago, and, you know, there's one guy who wants to follow Yeshua, and he says, but I got to go bury my parents. First he says, let the dead bury the dead. Let the blind lead the blind. He's saying, no. No, if you follow the traditions of men, you'll get lost, and you're gone. You're not going to follow me if you do that.
Right.
And then he said that what we needed to do was to take up our cross. And we see people, you know, going out at Easter and hauling wooden crosses around the street looking like they're suffering terribly. But he never suggested any of that silly crap. He said, there's something in you that mitigates against you living as you're designed to with full capability and as a human being, as love. So here, do the work that it's required to get you there. And instead of just living in the replicant mind that plays out the same things over and over and over again, coming to an actual live experience in the moment instead of just replaying what's stored in brain cells from the past. And that's where he talks
that really
about
makes,
there's a self that's going to die to do that.
Right. And really makes I just shorted my own self out. You were saying something. I was just right on that edge, and I paused a minute and I lost my train of thought. But it was give me a sec here. It was I do know that that if we're playing that, it sounds to me like if we're playing that, we're going to call it 9 bits, right? And for now, and if that 9 bits is, we're just living the same 9 bits, and once in a while we mess with a half of 1 bit, we're not really doing that passage in the Bible, and I do like this one that goes, lest ye be as little children, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven, that one.
Yeah.
And
get back to the present moment.
To me, that's not living childishly, like selfishly. No, it's being in the moment wondrous and trying to take it all in. and
being available
ties in being available, and it ties in a little bit with what even Picasso said when he said, "Youth has no age," and it's being in that moment. I have to say, I find myself being misinterpreted by some who are really locked in to their worldly paradigm. If I'm in the moment, sometimes I just don't really, maybe the problem is just completely in the way I'm expressing it, but it seems like I get misinterpreted that I'm really trying to be alive and open-hearted in the moment, and whoops, it doesn't always, it's maybe the right thing to do, but it's not always received by the world that way, you know?
I hear you.
That's not uncommon. Yeah.
That's so pretty much the game.
Yeah. Wow. And
yeah, when we can recognize that each person has a construct of their understanding about the world, and we can make space for somebody's reality to be totally different than mine. I mean, when you look at that, the idea of the 9-bit mind, in order for me to look at something and you to look at something and have a totally different construct, all I need is for 2 bits of data out of 9 to be different than yours, and I'm going to have a different reality about that thing. And you look at how many people, it's like their whole security in life is everybody's got to agree with me. As opposed to, oh, well, now that never looked at it that way. Whole different construct, because that particular mind is using different data. And then to realize that further, there's a way to tell, when the mind is using corrupt data. And that is that there's hostility or fear moving in it. And when hostility or fear moving, you know, the 9-bit mind, even the most intelligent of the 9-bit mind, when hostility or fear is moving, it's corrupt, and its perceptual construct is going to be garbage. And that's why it's so important to be able to collapse it, which is what forgiveness is.
Yeah, see, there it is. And it's the forgiveness and the love thing part that one of the times more recently when I was given a quick glimpse, it was actually a very geometrical viewpoint of how things work in a certain way. And it came to me, and I think it's the same thing that Yeshua was saying, was love first, then dance, then get involved in the dance of creation and the world. And you don't get lost, and you don't
be human. Be human first.
Yeah,
reclaim your human life, exactly. And in order to do that, he says there's a part of you that's going to have to die. We're going to have to kill off that hostility and fear-based self with its corrupt data and its corrupt picture of who we are to make space. There's a great line in what people call the Lord's Prayer that can be translated as asking the Creator, carve out a space in me for your wholeness. And our wholeness is of that nature, and to make the space for it to show up in the world and begin to express, to me, is the whole objective of this work. It's what we're here to do.
Ah, right, right.
So I join you in carving out that space, and we're down to the last few seconds, so the show is going to cut us off.
Oh, okay.
It would be a delight to carry the conversation on tomorrow if that fits, but in the meantime, I'm going to have to just say thank you for the input, the thoughts. Appreciate you, cherish you, and everybody, create the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.
www.whyagain.org.